from New York, it's the Gary Nall Show. And now, your host, Gary Nall.
Got my mojo working, but
everyone, I'm Gary Nall. Nice to have you with us today. We're going to be having a conversation with remarkable minds. This is an ongoing, very popular series. I've been doing it for over 20 years, where we try to find the people around the world who have something to say that's unique, that is radical in the concept of change. Today is Professor James Petras. He is a Bartell Professor Emeritus of Sociology at Binghamton University, and he's an expert in American interference in global politics, especially Latin America and the Middle East. He is prolific, 60 books, 600 articles in professional and peer-reviewed journals. We're going to talk about the politics behind the U.S. empire and its consequences for American citizens. Also today, we're going to look from a health and nutrition perspective about vitamin E and blood pressure, greater fiber, and living a longer life, substantially longer. Curcumin quiets the crosstalk in tumor cellular environments. Curcumin also can help with mesothelioma. Tart cherry juice could help improve joint symptoms. Vitamin D could help treat pancreatic cancer. Multiple sclerosis may be linked to a lower intake of key nutrients, from Johns Hopkins University. And exciting findings from a university in the Netherlands about vitamin K2, improving arterial function. And tea's benefits extend to old bones, from Osaka University in Japan. We have a lot to share on health and healing. Today is commentary day. Commentaries about how I believe, and these are my own particular perspectives, that we are entering a very dangerous five-year period. We have been accelerating towards this point, but now it's no longer hidden. It's blatant, where we're becoming a police state with totalitarian factions having power over our lives, over our bodies. For example, you think you own your body. But what happens if, for example, you want a child not to be treated for cancer with chemotherapy and radiation because there's no evidence that would help? You want an alternative therapy by an oncologist, a medical doctor, wanting to use a different therapy. They can take your child away. You want your child to go to school. They want the child's body to be immunized. But there's no science showing that what they're going to put in the child's body will help, but a great deal of science showing it can hurt the child. They own your child's body. You say that you are normal. They say you're bipolar. Guess who wins in a court? So I'm going to talk today about how DNA is turning us into a nation of suspects. Very important information from John Whitehead. David Petraeus and the hypocrisy of the national security state. What a double standard. He was caught and proven guilty and has pled guilty to giving classified information. And he was given a little smack on the wrist, a misdemeanor, wrist slap. $40,000 fine. Well, let's compare that with Edward Snowden. From Alfred McCoy, from torture to drone assassination, how Washington gave itself a global get-out-of-jail-free card. From The Guardian, U.S. jails are warehouses of sick, poor, and low-risk people. Do you have any idea how many Americans are in perpetual isolated environments? In prisons and jails, 80,000. That's torture. Partners in Stupidity in the War on Terror, John Acheson from Common Dreams. The Paramilitary Occupation of America, John Kishore. We have a lot to share. Let's begin. Vitamin E is a very important, I would call it a super antioxidant, because it can stay a long time in your blood, and it oxygenates the blood. It also helps to keep you from having strokes. It's a very healing nutrient, and it can trap free radicals and therefore lessen the likelihood that those free radicals would damage and alter your DNA. According to a new article in the Journal of Nutritional Science and Vitaminology, vitamin E can also lower your blood pressure. They did a major study at Japan's National Health and Nutrition Survey. They took a look at over 3,600 individuals, and they found that those who had the highest amount of vitamin A had the best blood pressure measurements. In fact, among participants whose vitamin E intake was among the top one-third, there was a 27% lower risk of hypertension. That's a big deal. So vitamin E, how much vitamin E and what type? I suggest mixed tocopherols, and I suggest between 400 to 800 units a day in divided doses. Also, the best time to take vitamin E is before you go to bed. Now, another study in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition shows that fiber is really underrated. It can lower your risk of dying from any cause over an average of almost 6 years among men and women who are taking the most fiber. They studied 7,216 subjects at an increased risk of cardiovascular disease enrolled in the prevention Mediterranean study. And these are people who are on the Mediterranean diet who have cardiovascular disease. And they take a look at you every year in detail. And what they found was that among those who had the highest intake of fiber, that's about 33 grams per day, they had a 37% lower adjusted risk of dying from all causes. Now, that is terrific to have 33 grams of fiber a day, but I don't even start people at less than 40, and I ideally believe you should have 50. So imagine how lower your opportunity would be to die from any cause if you had 50 grams of fiber a day. But still, it proved the point, and that was published in a mainstream journal. I like to, when I'm traveling, I have bags of dried organic fruit shipped to locations because I don't know how long I'm going to stay, how long I'm filming in a particular area. Sometimes I decide I'd like to stop along the way and talk with people because that's how you find out stuff. Not from books, from talking, observing. For example, I would never have thought that the effects of the Gulf War spill would have been so devastating to people who are not immediately on the Gulf. But when traveling through Louisiana, Alabama, Mississippi, Arkansas, and Texas, and the Florida Panhandle, you start to hear about people who are sick, who have conditions they never had before, who are living within an hour of the Gulf, and then you start to realize that that oil also vaporizes and it smells. So the pheromones in the air, the particulate matter you're breathing in, and that doesn't get expelled from the body easily. But how would you know that unless you talk with people, because there weren't any articles written about it, because it was invisible. People kind of adapt to it. So I believe it's very important that we take the time and talk with people and listen to them. Try to get a better perspective, certainly a broader perspective. So long time ago, at the very beginning of my career, I was invited to a vegetarian retreat upstate. I'd never gone to a vegetarian retreat. There were no vegetarians outside of my great aunt where I grew up. No one was vegetarian. In fact, they thought it was just stupid and squirrely and strange, and I guess I was all those things because, you know, that's what I wanted to eat. So here was an opportunity to learn something. And the person who invited me was a long time, a 90-year-old woman. And what I remember most about her was the vibrance in her smile and her face. Her eyes were just white. She didn't have any bloodshot. Her skin was just terrific. And she's 90 years of age. She had come to a lecture of mine. And she asked me about vegetarianism. So there was this place up in the Catskills. Already at that point, the Catskills was dying. It had had its day in the 1940s, 50s, and 60s. Now this was the early 70s, and it was over. Yes, you had the Grossingers and Homewack and Granite and Evelyn and the Concord, and I would do retreats there, and which, by the way, to this day, I have people tell me how much fun they had at these week-away retreats where I'd bring in the greatest minds I could find in the health field, Linus Pauling. They were all there. And we would exercise and have great meals and lectures, and I hired Jackie Mason, Little Anthony Imperials, Dick Shawn, all these people at that time. It was just one of those remarkable moments in life, things I treasure. And so here, this was not any of these places. This was an old building. When we pulled up, the grass was overgrown. It was about 2-3 foot high. It was the middle of August. It was very warm. And the house looked like someone had abandoned it. And as we're walking around, I see an empty swimming pool that's all cracked and overgrown. But inside, there were a bunch of people. And these people were all older vegetarians. And I don't believe anyone in the room was under 60 or 70. But they were all very nice. And it was an extremely opportune time for me because I'm a novice. I don't know anything. So I was just a sponge all weekend listening. And the one thing that stood out was that they had an enormous amount of fiber in the diet. And they understood organic. They were eating organic. They were eating what they grew. They had a reverence for life and animals. They were very big in natural hygiene. They would do sun bathing where you go outside. I'd never heard of this before. I'd heard of being in the sun, but this was called airbrushing, where they would take these like a loofah, and they would scrub their skin. And here you had all these people outside and scrubbing their skin for a half hour. And I'm looking at this thing. This is something I'd never seen before. It was a hoot. But everyone throughout the day would have this little cup of freshly made tart cherry juice. Now, I'd never had tart cherries. Where I came from, there was only sweet cherries. And I would sneak up a treat. I'd eat as much until I'd get my stomach aches, and then I would get out the tree. And so here I'm drinking this stuff, and boy, I put a pucker on. I mean, it was like drinking lemon juice. And I said, why are you drinking tart cherries, the juice? Because it keeps your joints healthy. Because it kills pain in the body. We don't have any arthritis or bursitis, or we don't have any of these pains. Now, there are about 25 people. And to have that many people that old, because where I came from, no one ever lived that long. I mean, 60 was old where I grew up. Mind you, I'm growing up in the Ohio Valley, one of the most polluted areas in America. In fact, the single most polluted area of America for decades has been the Kanawha Valley, from Charleston, Huntington, Parkersburg, and then Wheeling. That's the most, and then Weirton, running right up the state. That's the most, and it's a small state. You can drive from one end to the other in 2.5 hours. That's the most polluted area of America, and studies have shown that. Plus, everyone smoked. Plus, everyone ate huge amounts of meat. Plus, after high school, nobody ever exercised. Wonder why they died young. So here are people who are showing me vitalism, loving nature, quality relationships. They read the classics. That's what that was the fun part of the day. I'm a avid reader, and I love the classics. But they would sit, and each one would read from the classics. And they spoke multiple languages. I didn't find out all the things they did, but there were retired professors there. These were some heady people, but wonderful people. The point is that I saw for the first time in my life an example of how people were making different choices and having different outcomes. And the idea that here's a group of people, I'm guessing, were about 75 years average. who had no diseases, no high blood pressure, no heart disease, no cancer, no macular degeneration or cataracts. They didn't wear glasses. They weren't overweight. They were trim and lean. They were vibrant. They were vitalists. And they were engaged in life, not retiring at all, and eating to enliven. And they were drinking this cherry juice. From the Journal of Functional Foods, a report from the University of Newcastle in England that revealed the benefits of tart cherry juice concentrate in reducing factors contributing to painful joints. In this blinded two-phase randomized crossover design study, a Dr. Houston and colleagues gave 30 to 60 milliliters of Montmorency tart cherry juice to 12 participants twice a day for 2 days, a washout period of 10 days or more separated each treatment phase. Blood and urine samples were collected before and after. Reduction in both serum C-reactive protein, a marker of inflammation, and urate, which is elevated during gout attacks, were observed following consumption of either dose of tart cherry juice, and it worked. So, here I'm reading a study this morning, reminding me of something from when I was in my very early 20s, from a group of very wise men and women, who unfortunately weren't motivating other people because the mainstream media just didn't believe in this. Too bad. They were right. The mainstream media is almost always wrong. Vitamin D deficiency common in men and women undergoing thyroidectomies. The American Academy of Head, Neck, and Surgery at its annual meeting talked about vitamin D deficiency and is saying, want to help your thyroid? Make sure you're getting vitamin D. Also, an article in the peer-reviewed journal Cell reports a potential benefit for a synthetic derivative of vitamin D in the treatment of pancreatic cancer. The compound works by changing a tumor's microenvironment, and the microenvironment, when activated by tumor cells, fuels cancer growth and impedes the entry of immune cells or cancer drugs. And this was done at the Salk Institute. They found a modified form of vitamin D inactivated liver stellate cells, which become activated during injury. So, the takeaway message is, if you want to protect your pancreas, take vitamin D. If you have pancreatic cancer, definitely take vitamin D. Also, curcumin. A good article in PLOS One shows that BCM95, curcumin, altered the microenvironment of a colorectal cancer cell culture model, thereby reducing tumor-promoting factors and potentially enhancing chemotherapy effect. And so how did that do this? They found out that curcumin quiets the crosstalk in tumor cell environment and hence allows greater healing. Also, a separate article in Clinical Cancer Research showed that malignant mesothelioma, a cancer of the lining of the lungs that is largely attributable to asbestos exposure, could face a worthy opponent in the form of curcumin. The group of scientists found that curcumin was able to inhibit the cells of cancer. So that's good. So we've known that curcumin makes a difference for a long time. And also, multiple sclerosis may be linked to a lower intake of a key nutrient. According to Johns Hopkins University, women with multiple sclerosis may have lower intakes of folate and vitamin E than healthy people. So, quote, since multiple sclerosis is a chronic inflammatory disorder, having enough nutrients with anti-inflammatory properties may help prevent the disease or reduce the risk of attacks from those who already have multiple sclerosis. That was done at Johns Hopkins University. Antioxidants, quote, are critical to good health and help reduce the effects of other types of damage that can occur on a cellular level and contribute to neurologic disease like multiple sclerosis. You bet, but it wouldn't be folate and vitamin E that I'd be focused on. With multiple sclerosis, you want to focus on black cumin seed oil. And garlic extract could help cystic fibrosis patients fight infection. This is from the University of Edinburgh. Quote, a chemical found in garlic can kill bacteria that cause life-threatening lung infections in people with cystic fibrosis. The study is the first to show that the chemical, known as allicin, could be an effective treatment against a group of infectious bacteria that is highly resistant to most antibiotics. Now, this audience knows that allicin is produced naturally by garlic bulbs to ward off a closely related group of plant pathogens found in soil and water habitats. And so it works against bacteria and, I might mention, viruses as well. One more reason to take this. And from Osaka University in Japan, researchers in Japan say black tea could help treat osteoporosis. Well, that's a big deal. That's a bone condition affecting tens of millions of people. That's what the study showed. And so make sure you're getting your, I would say, 200 to 400 milligrams a day of your black tea extract. I'm Gary Knoll. That's the latest on health and healing. From our environmental segment today, California is pumping water that fell to Earth 20,000 years ago. From Tom Hudson from Center for Investigative Reporting, he talks about the impacts of California's unchecked groundwater pumping are well known. By the way, you've seen there's been, and we have a lot of people from California listening right now, a lot of rainfall. It's done nothing. Zip. In fact, last year, the amount of extreme drought was 20% in California. Now, even after this recent torrential rain, it's 40%. That rain only benefited the northwestern part of the state and the southeastern part of the state, the very ends of the state. Otherwise, you're in a massive, unrelenting, long-term drought, which will make living in California for the vast majority of people in industries unsustainable. So we now know that the dropping water levels, the dried up wells, the slowly sinking farmland in parts of the Central Valley, which I recently flew over, and I'm looking as I'm on my way to Fresno, I'm looking at how parched everything is. Now, I've gone up and down California many, 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 many times. I've never seen it this bad. But another consequence gets less attention. One measured not by acre feet or gallons per minute, but by the long march of time. As California farms and cities drill deeper for groundwater in an era of drought and climate change, they no longer are tapping reserves that percolated into the soil over recent centuries. A message to the legislators, to the governor, to the people of California. If you're not aware of it, you're now pumping water that fell to Earth during a much wetter climate regime, the Ice Age. Such water is not just old, it's prehistoric. It is older than the earliest pyramids on the Nile, older than the world's oldest tree, and which is the bristlecone pine. It was swirling down rivers and streams 20,000 years ago when humans were crossing the Bering Strait from Asia. Tapping such water is more than a scientific curiosity. It is one more sign that some parts of California are living beyond nature's means, with implications that could ripple into the next century and beyond as climate change turns the region warmer and robs moisture from the sky. Quote, what I see going on is a future disaster. You're removing water that's been there for a long, long time, and it will probably take a long time to replace it. We're mining water that cannot be readily replaced, end quote. And that is Vance Kennedy, a 91-year-old retired research hydrologist in the Central Valley. But despite such concern, the antiquity of the state's groundwater isn't a well-known phenomena. It has been discovered in recent years by scientists working on water quality studies and revealed quietly in technical reports. So what is the takeaway message? Groundwater is crucial to California. In an average year, nearly 40% of the state's water comes from underground resources. In the current extended drought, it's more than half. 80% of California residents rely upon this water to some degree. Some towns, cities, and farming are entirely dependent upon it. So my suggestion is that if you really cared about California, you should have the hydrologist show you where you will have water in the future, in the areas you won't, and then start structuring a plan to help people move, whether it's farms, factories, or populations, because otherwise, there's just no way these people are going to have water. From our public health segment today, we're now at 4 years and counting on Fukushima. What do we know for sure? We know that nothing is stopping the radiation going in the air and water. We know that it's covering the entire planet in larger or smaller degree, depending upon where you're at in the winds and currents. And we know that the officials, all the officials at all levels of government and industry are lying about its impact. The latest from Energy News, quote, ABC Australia, radiation levels posing cancer risks. Before the disaster, there was just 1 to 2 cases of thyroid cancers in 1 million Japanese children. But now Fukushima has more than 100 confirmed or suspected cases, having tested 300,000 children. It is expected thyroid cancer could turn up 4 to 5 years after a nuclear disaster. And now they have 1,232 confirmed deaths in Japan's Fukushima prefecture over the past year, linked to nuclear accident 4 years ago. That's up 18% from a year earlier. So, that's ABC reporting. Now, here's my thought on this. I would suggest, and we're heard in Japan, we have a lot of activists who listen and conscientious people in Japan, that you start to realize that radiation does not obey any mandates by man. It's no different than the stupidity of people living within a reasonable distance from, let's say, from our Indian Point, about 38 miles directly north of New York City. What you have is you have 20 million Americans living within 50-mile range of the two Indian Point reactors. You have highly concentrated people living around all the reactors in the United States. Let's say there's an accident, like at Fukushima, and your safety zone is 10 miles. Can you show me the law of physics that will determine that the radiation will stop because of a zoning ordinance or a state or local mandate that this is your safe zone, but if you go 10 miles and 1 inch beyond that, you're safe? It's absurd. It's insane. And yet, think of the people who knowingly live near these nuclear facilities. They're being exposed to radiation 24/7. Every single nuclear reactor in the United States leaks radiation, and it gets into the air and water. And we're supposed to think that this is within safe bounds. It is not. Recently, a gentleman died 2 weeks ago, Dr. Ernest Sternglass. I believe he was 95. I knew Dr. Sternglass for a long time. I used to have him on my radio show a lot. And then he pretty much semi-retired about 10 years ago. He had a friend named Dr. Jay Gould that worked under the Carter EPA. Dr. Gould, Sternglass, and myself all co-authored an article, a scientific article, on how many people actually died from Three Mile Island. We were fortunate. We managed to get the death or the infant mortality rates before they were changed. And it showed 50,000 excessive deaths in immune-compromised and young people and babies downwind Three Mile Island. Yet we were told no one died, but we had the studies. Later, the studies had been altered. Someone had, with malice aforethought, changed the records. But we had the original copies. We rewrote a report on this, and it was widely distributed. And thank goodness we got it before it was altered. Plus, I went down and I interviewed the people in Three Mile Island, the whole community, all the cancers they had, and we had been lied to. So the people of Japan, you've been lied to. In fact, your government is nothing but a pathological, misogynist, racist group of punks. Now, that's the best I can say, because I'll hold some decorum because this is a radio program. But we have seen what they're capable of doing. The world has seen. The women of Japan have seen and been the victim of it. The workers of Japan have seen it. The power, the oligarchs. So do not believe them when they tell you, in the most populated city on earth, Tokyo, with 40 million people living in the immediate vicinity, that the 1,200 test sample is done, and Arnie Gunnarsson and others who are experts in this, showing that there is no safe area where there's not radiation in the Tokyo area. But then you have to ask, okay, that's not that far from Fukushima. How far do I have to go before I'm safe? What if I went 200 miles away or 300 miles? Well, Japan's a small island, and you have a lot of people. The trouble is there's no place to put those people. And the if you started acknowledging the dangers of nonstop radiation leaking, then the third largest economy in the world would collapse. So they covered up until they're able to deal with this. The trouble is they haven't dealt with it, and you're all suffering. If you live within 200 miles of Fukushima, I would move. I would move as far away as you can, because the wind doesn't honor our artificial physics. The wind will blow, the currents will take, and the melted radiation has gone into your aquifers, and it can never, ever be unpolluted. It's there forever. So the crops you grow with that polluted water will have radiation. So what you will have, you will have mandates from TEPCO, you'll have mandates from your government covering it up, and they've now passed a law that anyone exposing any corruption that embarrasses the government or corporations in Japan will be arrested. How about that for a reminder of Japan from the 1930s? That was before the rape of Nanking, wasn't it? Yeah. Gee whiz. You have such a disdain for the common person in Japan by your ruling oligarchs. Unfortunate, so don't trust them. They're pathologically dysfunctional. I'm Gary Noll. Now time for a thought process. A thought process that challenges us, and that is I'm sure you've seen, I posted unarmed people who were not committing a crime, not running out of a bank with, you know, bank money, hadn't just shot someone racing away. I'm talking about people who managed to get themselves killed by the police. And yet the police are always saying they were resisting arrest, or I felt threatened. Even SWAT teams will kill someone and say, we feel threatened. How could 12 guys with bulletproof vests and armed to the teeth go in and there's an unarmed man and you shoot him? How could you have felt threatened? What were you threatened of? But this is what's happened. This means that America, according to John Kishore, has become a paramilitary occupation. Now, it's necessary to call things by the right names. The obscene regularity of police murders in the United States has reached the point where it is appropriate to speak of the police as an occupying army, whose daily violence and brutality can best be described as a war against the country's poor and working people. Now, I can be wrong on this. Maybe I haven't seen the SWAT teams hitting hedge fund or Wall Street or corporate CEOs' homes. Maybe I didn't see the stop and search. It happened, but I just wasn't there. At people in Wall Street offices coming out, or in the theater district, or up and down Park Avenue, Fifth Avenue. Maybe when people are coming out of their building like David Rockefeller, they stopped and frisked him. I don't think so. Practically every day brings a new outrage. The death toll mounts relentlessly against the backdrop of harassment and beatings that are daily facts of life in much of the country. The government does not publish figures on police killings. However, according to statistics compiled from media reports, 1,000 people lose their lives as a result of police violence every year in the United States. That comes out to 3 dead people per day. Just this week, Anthony Hill, 27-year-old, Atlanta, Georgia, unarmed, naked, suffering from mental illness, and reported seeing hanging from his balcony and crawling on the ground. So what was their answer? They just shot him dead. Anthony Robinson, 19, Madison, Wisconsin, unarmed, shot dead by a police officer who forced his way into the victim's apartment building to shoot him. Derek Cruz, 26, from Volusia County, Florida, unarmed, killed in his home, victim of a no-knock SWAT raid that turned up 2 ounces of marijuana, shot him in the face. Ernest Adiaz, 28, Santa Ana, California, unarmed, killed in his car, father of 4, worked 2 jobs. The police killed him because, quote, he did not cooperate. How many times have you heard that the person was arrested for resisting arrest? But what was the charge? There were no charges. They were resisting being arrested for what crime? There was no crime. So you mean they were arrested for resisting arrest? That's right. Or shot dead for resisting arrest, but they hadn't committed a crime. That's correct. Orwell couldn't have written it to be more bizarre. So you haven't committed a crime, you've done nothing wrong, but you're wrong if you don't allow yourself as an innocent person to be arrested. That's how absurd it's gotten. Is the President of the United States, the Attorney General, every one of the adaptive, aggressive, downside sociopaths working at the Justice Department aware of this? Of course they are. Everyone's aware of this. No one is unaware of how bad it's gotten. It's just that they're not on the receiving end of it. Antoni Montez, 35, Pasco, Washington, unarmed, shot dead as his hands were raised on February 10th, and so it goes. So here's the takeaway thought. The mind-boggling level of police violence in the United States far exceeds that of any other major industrialized country. In Germany, there were 8 police killings in a 2-year period. In Canada, about a dozen people. In Iceland, in 40 years, none, 0. In the past year, more people were killed by the police in Pasco, Washington, than in all of Great Britain. Pasco has 68,000 people. Great Britain has 64 million. And they killed more in 1 year in Pasco, Washington, than in the last 3 years in Great Britain. Some of these killings are captured on video and become national news. The vast majority are not. One website that compiles local media reports killed by police documented 212 police killings in the first 70 days of this year. Like the military, the police are trained to see the population as a hostile force. They demand that anyone they encounter act with complete submissiveness. Failure to obey is punishable by a beating, a jolt of electricity, arrest, or summary execution. The local police have intimate ties with the uniformed military and Pentagon. The latter has transferred billions of dollars in heavy weapons and military-grade equipment, including armed vehicles, helicopters, automatic weapons, left over from the wars in Afghanistan and Iraq, to police departments across the country in a program fully endorsed and supported and promoted by President Obama. Aurora, Colorado, for example, where one of the people named Vincent was killed last week, has received $500,000 military equipment. So to account for the militarization of domestic policing over the past half century, one must examine the far-reaching changes in the structure of American society that have occurred. And while police violence, overwhelmingly directed against the working class and its struggles, has long been a classic feature of American life, the systematic militarization of the police has developed alongside the transformations that have taken place since the 1960s. Heavily armed SWAT teams first made their appearance in the later years of that decade in response to the urban uprisings and social upheavals of the period. By the end of the decade, the ruling class was repudiating the policy of social reform it had followed since the New Deal in the 1930s. At the end of the 1970s, political establishments launched an offensive against the jobs, wages, and living standards of the working class that has continued ever since. Law and order politics became the political cover of a rapid buildup of the police powers of the state, including the vast expansion of the prison system and the transformation of the police into a paramilitary force. These processes were intensified after 9/11 under the banner of the War on Terror. The police were integrated more directly into the massive military intelligence apparatus, the FBI, the CIA, the National Security Agency, and the Pentagon. The local police today are tied by a million threads to the national system of repression and control. This is what underlies the Obama administration's insistence on interventions in defense of the police, including Obama's statement supporting the exoneration of Darrell Wilson, the person caught who killed Michael Brown, and his declaration last week that, quote, the overwhelming number of law enforcement officers do their job fairly and they do it heroically. You think? You want to have that challenged? I'll challenge it. The political establishment views the whitewash of Wilson not as a local question, but as a national necessity. In defending the police and ensuring that there is no accountability for their crimes, Obama is upholding a critical part of the apparatus of repression. The police carry out so-called heroic work not in the service of people, but in the defense of the capitalist system and the ruling corporate financial oligarchy. As social struggles develop, the police are called on to ever more directly use the violent methods honed by the military abroad against the working class at home. Police violence is not fundamentally a question of racism, as claimed by the various organizations that orbit the Democratic Party. Shame on them, but there is no shame with the Democratic Party. Whatever role racism may play in any given act of brutality, police violence is embedded in the irrevocable conflict between the interests of capital class and those of its opposite, the working class. This basic class division of society has grown all the more explosive with the colossal growth of social inequality. This is why the fight against police violence must be rooted in the unification and mobilization of the working class, and the working class must see the fight against police violence as central to its own interest. In drafting the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson included among the long train of abuses and usurpations of the British king the following, quote, quartering large bodies of armed troops among us, protecting them by mock trial from punishment for any murders with which they commit. Then it was a question of overthrowing the British monarchy. Today it is a question of asking yourself, what is the cost of our current system to our well-being? I'm Gary Nall. Let's go over now. I've been told that our guest is standing by. Finally got him on board. Nice to have you with us today. Hello?
Hello?
Hi, Professor James Petras.
Oh,
nice to have you with us
today. Gary. How are you?
Good. I was waiting on you to be on the line. We won't have a lot of time, so I'm going to ask you one question that you can take your time and spend as much time as you want answering, all right? I'd like to begin with the events of 9/11, because this single day stands out as a global pivot point when the entire world changed for the worse. I remember before 9/11, the primary civil society issue being demonstrated in cities around the world was corporate globalization through institutions such as the World Bank, the International Monetary Fund, and the World Trade Organizations. After 9/11, much of that initiative within civil society was silenced. The inequalities of free trade were shelved in the back rooms, and most people in the United States and Europe quickly forgot about it. Now, whether a premeditated or orchestrated apparatus of global surveillance and U.S. military expansion was already in place prior to 9/11, only awaiting for the proper moment to be unleashed may be debatable. Nevertheless, after 9/11, it has been a multitude of bad foreign and economic policies each contributing to a further U.S. economic and military expansion and further reduction in the standard of living in America. The War on Terror, which was promulgated as a national security and global priority immediately after 9/11, has not subsided during these 14 years and has only intensified. And the definition of who and what are terrorists has expanded to include anyone who challenges the official dogma in Washington. So I'd like you to begin and speak a bit about philosophy about social security, military, and economic architecture of an emerging American imperium that was unleashed upon 9/11, and help us to understand to what end its mission is trying to reach. The forum is yours.
Well, the war on terror was really a declaration of war on a number of countries, particularly in the Middle East, but not confined to the Middle East. Essentially, it was the U.S. affirmation that it has the right and the power to engage in multiple wars, beginning with the invasion of Afghanistan, followed by Iran, and then subsequently Somalia, Libya, intervening with drones in Yemen, and now we have the intervention in the Ukraine and imposing a junta there that's essentially going to be a platform for NATO. And accompanying that is the fact that countries, in particular leaders, that didn't go along with the idea that terrorism is fought through terrorism was President Chavez in Venezuela. I was in touch with President Chavez, and I remember very clearly we shared the platform in Paris at the Sorbonne. He said a fellow from the State Department named Grossman came and insisted that President Chavez support the U.S. Wars, what he dubbed the war on terrorism. Chavez told him, no, you don't fight terrorism with terrorism. And Grossman replied, you're going to pay a price for this. And barely 4 months later, the U.S. backed a military coup led by a section of the military and business leaders that was defeated in record time, 48 hours, by a 1-million-person march. And that was the opening bell in what became a 13-year war against Venezuela for daring to defy the U.S., dared to set up and promote Latin American organizations, integration organizations that excluded the U.S., that demanded that the U.S. not intervene in any fashion in Latin America under any pretenses, whether it's the war on terrorism or anything else. And I think we've come down from that period to the present, in which Obama, following up on his war on terrorism, his bellicose rhetoric, now accuses Venezuela of being a national threat, a threat to national security and U.S. foreign policy. Now, people pay attention to the first part of Obama's statement, that the Venezuelans represent a threat to national security. Nobody in their right mind, even the lunatics that are running the asylum in the White House, believes that Venezuela, facing U.S. aircraft carriers in Aruba, military bases, 7 military bases in Colombia, U.S. Espionage bases in Central America, represents a threat to the U.S. It's the other way around, and everybody understands that. We also have the fact that Venezuela, leading these integration policies in Latin America, is carrying out significant welfare changes in terms of free medical care, free university education, social housing, subsidized food programs, etc., which are a form of developing an alternative to neoliberal politics, the free market. They're saying, look, the state has a role to play in ensuring essential living standards for most people, the great majority of working people. So you have two things going here. The war on terror is a subterfuge for expanding U.S. power in the Middle East, and that's largely a part of the overall foreign policy. The other thing is that any country which opposes and goes in the opposite direction and not prioritizing overseas wars but social welfare at home becomes automatically an enemy that's targeted. And this is what Obama's bellicose posture is all about, is mobilizing U.S. military armada to threaten Venezuela today and perhaps to invade Venezuela tomorrow or in the near future. And I think this is really a big issue all over Latin America today and should be a big issue in the U.S., particularly with the alternative media, because Washington is very serious. They backed a losing candidate in 2013 in Venezuela. They then organized and backed violent street demonstrations in 2014, trying to precipitate a regime change. And in 2015, they tried to organize a conspiracy with some military defectors and certain politicians to overthrow the government and bomb the presidential palace. And when those failed, Washington had lost important assets in trying to overthrow the government. So what's left? Obama says if our internal assets can't do it, let's send in the Marines, or threaten to send in the Marines, and make an announcement announcing that, in order to see what the weak spots in Venezuela are, or maybe precipitate a crisis so Venezuela has to allocate more resources, scarce resources, because of the decline in oil prices, toward buttressing their civil defense. And therefore, that will run the economy down a bit more. And with elections in September, maybe we can create so much economic difficulties that the opposition can finally win an election after losing 15 elections in the last, 17 years. I think that this is a mortal threat to democratic socialism. It's a vital threat to Latin American integration, and it all comes under this whole general policy of the war on terrorism, which came out of the dubious events on 9/11. I say dubious because it's very clear that one of the buildings collapsed without an airplane hitting it, and there's some question here whether it was a demolition job from the inside, and so U.S. precipitating the destruction in New York in order to launch a predated war on terrorism, which is an offensive directed at any adversary of the United States or Israel in the Middle East.
I have one more question for you. I cannot recall a time in American history, particularly during the Obama years, where there has been so many attempts at regime change in other nations. You mentioned Venezuela, but we also have Afghanistan, Iraq, Libya, Honduras, Egypt, the Ukraine, and Paraguay. Iraq is on the table again, as it's just about every nation in the Middle East, aside from Israel. In Latin American nations, an area of your specialty, you mentioned Venezuela, but also we have been intervening in Bolivia and Argentina. They're unsafe as far as U.S. intervention. Neither is Russia, for that matter. What might be most on Americans' mind is why. What are we actually doing meddling in all these nations' affairs, none of which pose any direct terrorist threat to the United States? Therefore, there is a much broader, wider agenda behind this that our mainstream media completely ignores or is just too damn simple-minded to perceive. How do you view this increase in regime change ventures we're witnessing under the Obama administration?
Well, I think in the 90s, Washington had their way. They had civilian governments and the neoliberal policies. They led to a crisis and a disaster, and either via elections or via popular uprisings, these pro-U.S. regimes were overthrown and replaced, and Latin America then took a different course. It moved toward greater independence in its foreign policy. It diversified its market. In some cases, it nationalized lucrative economic sectors, and it began to grow, and it began to lessen poverty and inequality, and demonstrate that an independent foreign policy coincides with greater welfare and greater democratic freedoms for the people. And this is unacceptable to the United States. This is really a threat to U.S. imperial domination when you have countries that are willing to develop ties with China, develop ties with Russia, open up trade relations with other states that are adversaries of the U.S., for example, with Iran. I think Washington finds this intolerable. They don't understand peaceful coexistence of different social systems, that countries may find it more lucrative to sign loan agreements with China at zero interest rates over 30 years than to go to the World Bank or the IMF, which are U.S. proxies, and be put under conditions. In other words, receive a loan only if they privatize their economy, only if they lower their trade barriers, only if they legislate measures that restrict collective bargaining, etc. You don't get any of that. China doesn't put any restrictions on your domestic policies in order to secure a loan, and that's much more attractive to any country than dealing with U.S. Banking proxies. So I think there is here a clear issue that Washington's bellicose posture has to do with the greater independence and diversity in Latin America and the challenge that they have to face, that the U.S. is not the only superpower in the world that can dictate policies, that Latin America has developed its own integration agreements. There's ALBA, Petrocaribe, UNESUR, CELAC, all these organizations that don't get much play in the United States, but have increased inter-regional trade, which has resulted in Caribbean countries now not voting the U.S. line in international forums.
Unfortunately, we'll have him back for more extended conversation. That you're listening to Professor James Petras, P-E-T-R-A-S. He is renowned for understanding American intervention in the Middle East and around the world. He is the author of The Politics of Empire, U.S., Israel, and the Middle East. His website is Lahane, LAHANE.org/Petras. I'm Gary Nall. Look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day. We'll be right back.